Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Pamela Stevenson Connolly is here to talk about the inner beastie in you, me, and in her as well. As you're probably aware, many years ago, Pamela Stevenson Connolly gave away comedy to take up another profession which allows you to ask interesting questions. Becoming a clinical psychologist helped her to unravel the complicated past of her husband, Billy Connolly. And since then, Pamela has interviewed hundreds of people in therapy sessions about their sex lives. And it's prompted her to write a book which covers sexuality throughout the human lifespan. It's full of real stories, and it's called Sex Life, How Our Sexual Experiences Define Who We Are. Pamela Stevenson Connolly, welcome back to Conversations.
Thank you. Good to be here.
One thing I'm struck about in interviews with you in the past is that people go, oh, she was in comedy, now she's a psychologist. I don't see that as a U-turn. I just don't. I see it as a kind of a logical next step.
Thank you. I definitely do. An examination of human behaviour. I mean, it seemed logical to me. I mean, I'm not saying it was easy, because I think it's quite hard to turn your back on something that you were sort of known for. But I was ready. I was bored with comedy. I'd sort of done everything I wanted to do. And it was actually very nice, quite a relief to disappear into my books for a while and then reemerge, set up a practice. And I've, you know, really enjoyed this career.
It allows you to ask weird, penetrating, slightly impertinent questions, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I could have become a radio presenter.
Heaven forbid. I have to ask you about this because this is the story of the day today from the United States. Congressman Matthew Weiner.
Good name.
Great name.
Excellent name.
I know. Name is destiny. I mean, you know, this is how it turns out. Poor Matthew Weiner has finally come clean, so to speak, and admitted that, yes, indeed, it was he who tweeted that picture of himself. He's him in the bathing suit area, to put it euphemistically, clad in cotton boxer shorts.
We've all done that.
Look, you know, which one of us can honestly say...
Which one? Can you put your hand on your heart and say you've never tweeted a picture of your own genitals to somebody?
Yet, here is his walk of shame, Pamela. This is what the poor man said earlier.
At the outset, I'd like to make it clear that I have made terrible mistakes that have hurt the people I care about the most, and I am deeply sorry. I have not been honest with myself, my family, my constituents, my friends. Last Friday night, I tweeted a photograph of myself that I intended to send as a direct message as part of a joke to a woman in Seattle. Once I realized I had posted it to Twitter, I panicked. I took it down and said that I had been hacked. I then continued with that story, to stick to that story, which was a hugely regrettable mistake. This woman was unwittingly dragged into this and bears absolutely no responsibility. I am so sorry to have disrupted her life in this way.
Oh, that's pretty cringeworthy, isn't it? Listening to that, he's insisting he's not going to resign. He's insisting his marriage will survive this, but he says he may seek psychiatric help. Does he really need it, Pamela?
Well, you know, when I hear stuff like this, it really just makes me so sad, because it's like, this is none of our business, really. I mean, all right, there's the argument, well, he lied. Well, you would, wouldn't you? It's like, you'd try to cover this one any way you could. I mean, yes, I mean, privately, he probably needs to look at, you know, at really... You know, that when somebody does something like this, very often when somebody gets caught in an affair, you know, then sometimes there's an unconscious part of the self that is sort of designing this. You know, I would wonder if there weren't something going on in his primary relationship where he sort of wanted to, sort of part of him wanted to get caught. Unfortunately, it's happened in the public stage. And, you know, I mean, I just think it's such a shame that he has to go and make this embarrassing mea culpa. I just don't want to know what's going on in people's sex lives just because they're politicians.
Well, that's it. It does beg the question, and we can talk about Bill Clinton here too. Why, given that these are, you know, he's an important man, he's a man, and as is Matthew Weiner to some degree, men of influence, and they have so much to lose, Why will a man be like that become so sexually reckless?
Well, I've just really answered that. I mean, I think there's probably an unconscious part of him that had a desire to sort of maybe change something up in his prime relationship. But I doubt that he intended it would happen this way. I don't think of him as being similar to Bill Clinton, because Bill Clinton, there was a bit of seriality about what he was up to, wasn't there? I mean, it was sort of one thing after another, really. And it was unlikely that would go undiscovered. And I mean, he was much more powerful than this guy. But let's take, who's the golfer again? The one who...
Tiger Woods.
Well, Tiger Woods. I mean, I felt the same thing. You know, here was a very, private and very painful situation that was going on between him and his wife. And, the sort of the gossipy part of us just loved sort of hearing that there was a golf club being... But at the same time, doesn't it make us feel like we want to go and take a shower? You know, we know intuitively this is nothing to do with us.
Well, this is what you call the inner beastie in your book, which is a lovely Scottish word, beastie, isn't it?
Well, I was really referring to our sexuality, the sexual urges that we have. And how many times a day do you reckon you think about sex?
Five, I reckon.
Oh, come on.
Ten? A thousand?
Oh, yeah. And the rest, come on. Yeah, I mean, that's
how do you
thing.
Know I'm not doing it right that's now? Pamela Stevenson Connolly. I used to watch you on television as a young, impressionable young teenager.
I'm amazed at your parents that you stay up that late.
Yeah, and occasionally you would disrobe. And you think that thought hasn't popped into my head right now.
Glad to be of service. obviously we can't act on all of our sexual urges, because then we'd be... like, too busy to do anything else.
That's right. I've got a radio show to put on.
Exactly. So many of us spend a lot of time, most of us, negotiating, the sort of the sexual thoughts. And we, there's a part of us, your strong sort of sexual impulses that are there. Then there are those people who, for whom, they wish that they had a sexual beastie with whom to contend. So, but nevertheless, that they think about that and they have a longing. So it's omnipresent, but because we're not baboons, It's always, a lot of us deal with this by sort of turning our backs and pretending that he's not there and just trying to sort of squash and deny. But what I'm saying in the book is that why don't we instead really get to know our sexual selves, learn a bit more about that? Because our sexuality is not just our physiology and our anatomy and, the way we like to do it. It's way more. I mean, it's all of the past experiences we've had. It's all the messages we had about sexuality from our caregivers, from society. It's our religion. It's the language we use. It's how we feel about our bodies.
Can I make an observation here?
Please.
You refer to him as he.
I know. My beastie.
That's
I hear
your
my
beastie?
Beastie as being male.
Why is he male?
Are you trying to shrink a shrink?
I am.
No, it's a good question. It's a good question. I think there's a, the major sex hormone for both men and women is testosterone.
So do you think it's a he for all of us?
So, well, no, I just think that that's the link I made in my mind, is that, testosterone is at work very often when it's about desire, when it's about...
I was reading how you say that sometimes you can see this inner beastie as a genie. And I think that's quite a useful thing in a way, because sometimes it's a genie that says, I can do all these great things for you. Mm. Other times it's a beastie that says, I will have what I will have.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what has got poor old Congressman Wiener into Wienergate, as it's now being called.
Well, I don't know anything about this guy, but maybe he's just a guy like many of us who, will be very playful about sex from time to time. And there's nothing intrinsically wrong with photographing yourself in your underwear and sending it to someone.
No, I suppose the point I'm making though is that sometimes it's a creature that makes demands of us that leads us into all sorts of areas, and you write about this. It's something that interrupts our sleep, tempts us to be intimate with people we ought to avoid, and gets us into all kinds of trouble. So then how do we live with this beastie? What advice do you give patients?
My advice is to get to know him, or her a bit better, and not to turn our backs on it. It's rather like the sort of the Jungian notion that you should get to know your own shadow. We all have this shadow side. I suppose in a sense the beastie is part of the shadow, but more the sexual shadow. That if we get to know this part of ourselves and understand that, you know, he's always been there, because our sex lives really start before we're born. There've been ultrasound of male fetuses with erections. So we know that there's a process.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What have they got in there?
Oh, a little Playboy, a little baby Playboy. No. I mean, obviously, they're almost certainly not, you know, there are no images that accompany these erections.
I hope not.
And no sort of self-stimulation.
So it's there, right from the start.
It's a physiological response. It's, you know, so our hormones, the hormonal activity and our physiology is preparing them for the creatures that they will become for the rest of their lives.
So you say the point is then to become acquainted with this, the inner beastie / genie. How do you do that? Can you do that on your own? I mean, away from the sex act itself, can you do that by asking questions of yourself? What do you suggest?
Well, I think that's a very good start, is to ask questions of yourself. It's to start really thinking more deeply. And one of the great questions to ask is, because we are so influenced by the messages we receive in childhood about sexuality, it's a good idea to get to know exactly how those messages have affected us. So asking, my mother thought that sex was ... or my father thought that sex was ... And it's not necessarily the things that were actually said, but the messages, the unspoken messages. Like when I said that, what flipped into your mind when I said...
Yes.
You're nodding because you don't want to tell me.
I do.
Well, what is it?
Well, no, you finish your sentence first, please.
Well, those unspoken messages are rather important, and perhaps the answer is that the messages that you gleaned, the unspoken ones, were that sex is, I don't know, could be dangerous, it could be okay for girls but not for boys, or more likely to be the other way around, that it's unmentionable,
shameful,
that it's
unpleasant,
shameful,
unclean,
unpleasant, dirty. Maybe you were lucky and got it's pleasurable and great, but not too many people got that message because we live in a very sex negative society.
So then the first questions you ask yourself is what you're saying is what did I grow up with? What messages were I getting growing up?
Where did I start with all of this? What was it like? Did I feel, because it's absolutely normative and expectable that a child's going to explore his or her own body. So what happened when I did that? Did other people find out about this? Was I punished for that? Was that very difficult? Did I actually get to know my own body in the appropriate way, which was, you know, in childhood, you know, learning how your body works? What happened when I started experimenting with other kids? Well, you know, show me yours, I'll show you mine. And those sorts of games are really because kids are budding little scientists. They're curious as hell and they want to know what's going on. You know, did somebody freak out and hit the ceiling when they caught me doing something like that? And did I get the message from that?
Sometimes parents need a little bit of warning, don't they?
It's never easy to be confronted with your kid's sexuality. But if we look back, you know, we see how much this influences us. If we begin to ask that and begin to understand, you know, all the sides of this and look at our own sexual style, are we very goal-oriented? Because being really goal-oriented in sex is sort of going to detract from our pleasure.
What do you mean by goal-oriented?
Well, if it's a race to orgasm, if it's just all about something, right? What am I trying to achieve? Because a lot of people have sex for reasons other than pleasure. It's like, why am I having sex? Am I having sex to placate someone? Am I having sex because I want to stay married? Am I having sex because...
See, I'm a guy.
I can.
See, you notice that? I just didn't get that straight away at the outset.
Yeah.
That is the goal,
there
isn't
are
it?
Guys, you know? There are guys that do have those feelings. But what about having sex because somebody else wants it and, you know, you may not even be that keen, but, you know, there'll be a row. There'll be a bad mood if you don't.
Sulking.
They'll be sulking. You know, and when you have sex, what's it about? You're trying to get a good review? Are you trying to, you know, prove something? Are you trying to show that you're a fabulous lover? Are you trying to sort of, give her 9 orgasms because Cosmopolitan says, or GQ, or whatever the magazine you're reading says
again,
that you should?
These are the millions of questions that women ask themselves. Guys are just plumb grateful, aren't they? I mean,
that can be true. Are you grateful? Are you just being grateful? You know, are you just so relieved that it's finally happening that you're not really enjoying it, and you're trying to get it over as quickly as possible, in case she suddenly changes her mind?
Dr. Pamela Stevenson Connolly, author of Sex Life, How Our Sexual Experiences Define Who We Are, I'm my guest in conversation. Yeah. I mean, that's the cliche. I'm just playing on cliches here, that it's necessarily more complicated for women. You know, there's that old quip of Woody Allen's that, you know, when sex is good, it's fantastic, but when it's bad, it's still pretty good. are these mainly issues that are there clear gender divisions here? Because you haven't divided the genders in your book or sexual orientation.
No, but I have talked quite specifically about things that go on for men and things that go on for women. I mean, there's a lot of mythology about male sexuality, for example. One of the biggest myths about sexuality is that they are automatically, as they age, going to lose their erectile capacity, which is simply not true. I mean, things happen. Illness, somebody becomes diabetic, they're going to have an issue with erections. But, you know, their erections might not be as instantaneous as they were when they were 20. They might not point the ceiling. They might not be as firm as they once were. But they're still going to do the job. And, you know, just the sort of the belief that a lot of men have that they're going to deteriorate sexually as they grow older, I think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy very often. They start believing that they're not going to be able to function well. When in fact, you know, men often become much better lovers as they age. Just the fact that it might take them a little bit longer to become aroused is a good thing from the female point of view. If we're talking about a heterosexual couple, the female will probably be quite grateful for that. I mean, he might, you know, actually take more time than he used to take. There might be a little bit more focus on her sometimes.
Well, a couple of years ago, I had Bettina Arntin, the sex psychologist like yourself, who wrote a book about mismatched libidos that couples experience in later years, in their 50s onwards or thereabouts. And her argument was that it's often, you know, women that lose the intensity of libido that they might have once had, and this is a source of grief to many men in relationships. And her advice was that for women, really, if the best thing to do under the circumstances would be to get in the boat and start paddling, so to speak, and you might find you're enjoying it anyway. What do you think of that advice? What's your view on that?
Well, you know, what I found in the book, for example, was that there were many women that is another notion that's out there. But I honestly don't find that. I didn't particularly find it in my practice. What I found was that there tended to be a time around about menopause when women did, you know, their hormonal activity was, the estrogen was being depleted, testosterone was being a bit depleted, which, by the way, starts happening when you're roughly 35. So it's not like it suddenly, you know, it's a process that's been happening for some time, that it was starting to dwindle, and their libido might be mucked around with for a while. But as they got through that period and they began to discover, all right, they've got more leisure time, they don't have to worry about kids, they don't have to worry about pregnancy, and not only that, they begin to be wonderfully freed of a lot of the bodily concerns. They're not young women young women are much more concerned about being beautiful and being perfect for their partners than older women are, and they're more likely to simply enjoy pleasure. And it's the same for men. I mean, they are much more likely, I suppose, at a certain point to just sort of say, well, look, we're never going to be 21 again. Why don't we just enjoy this? They recognize that it's precious, it's life-affirming, it's about quality of life, and just get on with it. If they will allow themselves to do that. But all too often, this sort of mythology gets in the way. Well, it's never going to be as good again. Well, that's rubbish. It can be. You can be sexual until the day you die.
You've found in your book that people remain sexual. What are some of the older people?
Well, I spoke to people in their 90s who are still having fabulous orgasms. I mean, either sex for one or two,
in their 90s.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I had a man who wrote to me. I write a column for The Guardian newspaper in London, and a man of 92 wrote to me once and said, I'm having fantastic intercourse with a woman of 86. Should we be doing this? And that, you see, that is the, it was like, duh, how fantastic. And of course you are, and there are others like you. But just the fact that you're questioning it is really, I mean, what a shame that you think that there might be something wrong with that. It's fantastic.
That's right. It's the kind of thing that Winston Churchill would have said, makes you proud to be British. Hearing stories like that. There is, there are often in the culture close links between sex and death, eros and thanatos, those things. So there's a great quote you've gotten there from...
Oh, you're a Jungian.
No, I'm just say those words, that's all. Maybe. There's a great quote in there from Charles Bukowski that says, the dissolute barfly writer, I'm quoting him here from your book, "Sexual intercourse is kicking death in the ass while singing." That's a great quote. That's fantastic.
Well, there is something very life-affirming, isn't there? And it's one of another reason why, you know, as people... age, you know, I wish we weren't so judgmental about sex among elders, because, you know, they have a right to continue to enjoy it, and we should just stop being so judgmental and refusing them the privacy that they need, which often happens in residential homes and so on, getting into their business as younger families. It's really not fair. It's healthy. It is life-affirming. They begin to recognize how precious it is, which is something younger people tend not to recognize, and simply to enjoy it. There's this whole thing about pleasure. Have you noticed in our society, we hardly ever use the word pleasure without putting the word guilty in front of it.
Really? Even these days? Are you serious?
Yes. Yes, I'm very serious.
You're talking about this. Aren't you talking about the 50s?
No,
here?
I'm really not. It's like it's guilty pleasure. Come on, you know, just to... I don't know who you hang out with, but...
Well, you know, us ABC types, you know what we're like.
Well, but it's part of it's because we're under such pressure to earn money, and you know, with the financial climate, the more that becomes tricky, the more that people are, you know, they spend so much, we spend so much time working, we're trying to earn money, and you know, just taking time off that and just really enjoying something, whether it's sex or anything else, becomes, you know, a little bit, you know, less than what we should be aspiring to.
I think something inherent in that quote there by Bukowski is that the sex act is an act of laughing defiance at death. It's like a victory.
Well, it is.
Over death. And there's
Absolutely.
Procreation involved very often as well.
Absolutely.
So new life is created.
Absolutely.
That's something that's buried right at the heart of it. Maybe that's...
Look at how many people have sex at a funeral. You always have sex at funerals, don't you? I do.
I'm trying to remember.
I'm kidding.
I might have waited until I got home.
Well, that's what limos are for, dummy.
Why the hearse is so big. I've heard anecdotally stories of people who have terminal illness becoming incredibly horny. There's something about they know they're about to die, and yet something, I don't know how it works physiologically, but it kicks off this feeling, I must procreate. Maybe that's a kind of a Darwinian thing. I must send my genes out into the world one last time. Have you heard stories like that?
Well, I haven't actually heard that they become hornier, but probably we think that if anybody wants to have sex when they're terminally ill, that's a bit strange. But it's actually not. I mean, I spoke to a lot of people who are challenged with disability or, you know, serious illness, and they were really struggling to get information that they needed, for example, from physicians. There was kind of a sense that they shouldn't be still interested in sex, or that they had become asexual because they were physically challenged.
Yeah, that's
in some
incredibly
way,
unfair.
Which
isn't
is
it?
Really
yeah,
unfair. Yeah. And so, I've sort of made the case that we need to, you know, remember that they are that, you know, to suddenly become ill, for example, and to suddenly lose your sex life is a terrible loss, and. Of course, if you value it, you're going to fight for it. And I hope that they will fight for it. And if they're not getting the information and the help they need about how they can continue to be sexual despite whatever's going on with them physiologically, then they should, you know, find someone else.
You're careful in your book to make the point that there is no such thing as normal and that you think anything should go so long as it's safe, sane and consensual.
Yes.
Sane's an interesting word here.
Yeah.
Isn't there always a kernel of madness? in sex. And if it ain't, it's something that's pretty perfunctory and unenjoyable.
Well, first of all, you're right, but the way that it's defined for the purposes of something that's, you know, okay sexually, is sanity. That would be, you know, sort of sound in mind, as we'd assume, like capable of giving consent. Now, you're not capable of giving consent if you're wasted on alcohol or drugs. So, you know, that would be one of the things that would cut out, you know, sexuality under those circumstances. But you're right. I always love the quote of Robert Stoller that kitsch is the corpse that's left when art has lost its anger. And I think it that sexuality is the same. That it's that in great eroticism, there is always that edge of darkness that that makes it that much more exciting.
Pamela, thank you. And thank you for that quote, because I'm going to mull over that for the rest of today. That's a fantastic quote. I love that. Thank you so much for being returning to Conversations as it is. Thank you so much
for
being my guest once again.
Really nice. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.